We continue in Scripture this morning in the Gospel of Mark. We're reading from chapter 6. Listen now. King Herod heard of it, for Jesus' name had become known. Some were saying, "John the Baptizer has been raised from the dead, and for this reason these powers are at work in him." But others said, "It is Elijah." And others said, "It is a prophet like one of the prophets of old." But when Herod heard of it, he said, "John, whom I beheaded, has been raised." For Herod himself had sent men to arrest John, bound him, and put him in prison on account of Herodias, his brother Philip's wife, because Herod had married her. For John had been telling Herod, "It is not lawful for you to have your brother's wife." And Herodias had a grudge against him and wanted to kill him, but she could not. For Herod feared John, knowing that he was a righteous and holy man, and he protected him. When he had heard him, he was greatly perplexed, and yet he liked to listen to him. But an opportunity came when Herod, on his birthday, gave a banquet for his courtiers and officers and for the leaders in Galilee. When his daughter Herodias came in and danced, she pleased Herod and his guests. And the king said to the girl, "Ask me for whatever you wish, and I will give it." And he solemnly swore to her, "Whatever you ask me, I will give it, even half of my kingdom." The girl went out and said to her mother, "What should I ask for?" Her mother replied, "The head of John the Baptizer." Immediately, the girl rushed back to the king and requested, "I want you to give me at once the head of John the Baptist on a platter." The king was deeply grieved. Yet out of regard for his oaths and for guests, he did not want to refuse her. Immediately, the king sent a soldier of the guard with orders to bring John's head. He went and beheaded him in the prison, brought his head on a platter, and gave it to the girl. Then the girl gave it to her mother. And his disciples heard about it. And then they came and they took John's body and laid it in a tomb.
God, how are we to respond to friends and family who continue to justify cruelty and discrimination against others?
God, will the world ever be a common humanity, working together to solve problems and live in peace?
Why do Christians bicker over matters of the church?
Why is there abortion?
How can we be tolerant of people who are intolerant?
This week on As the Bible Turns, Michal, Saul's daughter, burns with hate for her husband David, and David dances without appropriate undergarments, and everyone was watching. What will Michal and the other real housewives of Jerusalem do to make love or war between the house of Saul and the house of David? And Herod's birthday party goes off the rails when John the Baptist's head is delivered on a platter. Is King Herod really just a dirty old man? Will his kingdom turn against him because he divorced his wife to marry his brother Philip's wife? Will Jesus of Nazareth be the next victim of Herod's insecurity? Now, anyone who says the Bible is boring hasn't read it very closely. This book is filled with relationship drama as cringeworthy as Keeping Up with the Kardashians. And there's as much bad parenting in here as Here Comes Honey Boo Boo. Violence, And the Bible can give Quentin Tarantino a run for his money. So why are we surprised? Why are we surprised that human life includes conflict? Why are we scandalized by disagreement or discord? Of course there's conflict. Conflict is as old as human existence. The Bible tells us so. Conflict is not the problem. The way we deal with conflict is the problem. So why do we have such a problem with the very existence of conflict? Let's take a closer look at our social location. White supremacy culture socializes all of us to avoid conflict and to expect conformity. White Christians often carry the banner of the aspiration of unity, while most white dominant churches display very little skill at cultivating communities where there is the kind of honesty about disagreements and discord that is really required for true unity. You see, we mistake being polite and nice for unity. We would rather avoid than have to deal with tension and disagreement with unresolved feelings. White supremacy culture tells us to think in terms of either or instead of the more ambiguous both and that both and actually more accurately reflects reality. White supremacy culture tells those in power, those in the dominant culture, that we have a right to be comfortable. We have a right to avoid conflict, and that we're justified when we pathologize those who bring too much emotion to a situation, those who ask us hard questions, those who confront us with hard truths. White supremacy culture tells us that power dominates, power controls, power enforces conformity, it expands influence, it conquers opponents. Now, when I use this term, white supremacy culture, I can feel us all tense up a little bit. White supremacy culture is a constellation of dynamics that define white dominant institutions and societies, like the Presbyterian Church USA, like the United States of America. But when I use this cultural description, I want you to hear me. I am not saying we are all overt racists. So take a deep breath there. When I use this term, I'm not saying we're all overt racists. What I'm saying is we've been formed by a culture that tells us that white ways of doing things are superior to the ways that other cultures do things. White supremacy culture is about power and how we're taught to use it. And you and I, we have found ourselves in this cultural moment in which these white ways are being interrogated. And they are being investigated. And they are being scrutinized. And they are being dismantled. So for us, for the church, for us to participate in a life-giving way in this healing work of dismantling white supremacy in our society, we cannot assume a defensive posture. So take another deep breath. We are called to have an open stance, a vulnerable and transparent stance. How we come to conflict, how we come into the tension of this cultural shift, that has a profound amount of magnitude. Our country is going through a seismic shift. For us to participate in that in a life-giving way, we must understand this work as spiritual practice. It is an act of faith. We need God's help. Now, I hope you'll agree with me. Jesus was not a conflict avoider. He was also not a one-trick pony. He showed us the full range of human emotion: joy, anger, anguish, frustration, compassion, sadness, love, irritation, generosity, fatigue, and hope. So why do we struggle so to follow his lead in such courageous and resilient self-understanding? Why do we struggle to see people and ourselves as beloved, as in need of healing, as worthy of our time and attention the way Jesus sees them, the way Jesus sees us? God, in your mercy, help us. This week on As Facebook Turns, the Sights, Sounds, and Algorithms of American Disharmony. A huge diapered balloon baby floats over London, and 250,000 protesters of a sitting American president. Video footage of congressional diatribes and senatorial temper tantrums. Oh, and also don't forget, goat yoga is all the rage. Like it or not, Facebook is one of the world's main vehicles of public discourse these days. Social media platforms form social commons where we encounter every kind of expression, and it swims in the morass of algorithms and Russian bots and echo chambers, even as it brings people together across barriers of geography, culture, time zone, perspective, and ideology. Now, some of you have joined me this week on Facebook in a discussion that has erupted on my Facebook page. It was a reaction to a simple tweet that I posted. It was really not a very complicated or insightful observation. It was this: some reactions to Maxine Waters are so profoundly twisted. She suggests oppressed people are tired of being nice. And then criticism of her boldness takes the form of death threats, racial slurs, and dehumanizing accusations. Hashtag, white supremacy is a disease. So far, people from every chapter of my life, from all over the country, all over the map, religiously and politically, of diverse racial and gender identities have commented. It's already garnered 140 comments, and there were still comments rolling in between services today. Now, we can easily cringe at how awkward and artificial and irritating comments on Facebook can get. And no doubt, if you've been following this thread, you have had some of those moments. But I learned back in the days of angry and aggressive football fans trolling my website and my Twitter feed that social media is also a great space to practice some of the antidotes of white supremacy thinking and behavior. With all of its thoughts, Facebook is actually a space where we can practice what it feels like to share power. Instead of engaging competitively, defensively, dispassionately, or with shame or blame or impatience or fragility, we have a chance to share power by practicing skills like appreciation. Thank you for caring enough to share your thoughts. Perseverance. This is hard, but I'm going to stay engaged. Self-awareness. I'm starting to feel really irritated about some people, and I'm starting to feel kind of negative about myself. I'm going to take a break. I'm going to go outside and listen to the birds sing. Generosity. This must be really important for this person to want to keep going in this conversation like this. Vulnerability. Here's why I feel the way I do. I have a story to tell. Honesty. Your comments are confusing. I'm having trouble following you. But before you go into the fray, for it to be a true spiritual practice, we have to ask ourselves a very important question about how and why our power will be deployed. Remember, power is simply the capacity to make an impact. And that question for you, for all of us to sit with, is what is at stake for me in this interaction? Sometimes it might just be to maintain connection, however thin that connection might be. Sometimes it might be about a confrontation, because there's a problem or a pressing need to speak out, and then we have to be ready to sit with the tension and not move too quickly to try to resolve it. Sometimes it's about gaining understanding, and then I prioritize just listening, just be present, resist the temptation to control the flow of information. How do we respond to family and friends who continue to justify cruelty and discrimination against others? Why do Christians bicker over matters of the church? Why is there abortion? What is at stake for you in these questions? What is the story behind why church bickering and abortion and the hurtful tensions in families are weighing on your heart? God, in your mercy, embolden us. This week on As GCPC Turns, blown fuses and frustrating hot water heaters threaten the sanity of staff members. Twice in one day, 12 and then 20 people pack into a room to voluntarily talk about white supremacy. 10 people say yes to taking the lead in helping us be a godparent, patrino, church to someone who needs support because her husband was detained in the ICE raids. People reach out and talk about their pain and take a chance on believing that someone might actually care, even when they've been hurt by the church in the past. People come with their stories. Remember Michal, in our reading of 2 Samuel, she has a story. If you just read our passage for today, if you just read that little soundbite, that how she burned with hatred for David, you could take her for a petty and bitter woman. But if you listen to her story, you will know that Michal's feelings for David come from an excruciating place. Listen to Dr. Will Gaffney share Michal's story. Michal had been used by her father to trap David, and used by David to escape the trap. Her father used her body to punish David, giving her to another man as his wife, still married to David in the eyes of the law and in her heart, probably still in love with him. Now she has to sleep with the strange new man her father has given her body to. How she must have longed for David, that swashbuckling hero and rebel bandit, to come to her rescue. And then when he did, he came with two other women in tow. Michal might have been content to live with David and his new wives. That was the way of kings, and she was a king's daughter. But David didn't want her as a woman or a wife. He wanted her only back as a possession. She was his, and no one else could have her. He took her back, and then he abandoned her. The text does not say that she was barren. That would mean she and David were sleeping together if it says she does not have a child, meaning that David did not give her one. Michal had to watch as David impregnates Abigail and Ahinoam. She watches as David passes her by and marries and impregnates Maacah multiple times, and Haggith and Abital and Eglah. All of these wives and their children are listed before Michal, before she sees him cutting like a fool at that Ark festival. Is there any wonder she despised him in her heart? That may have been the first time she had seen him in person since he took her back. And Michal will later have to watch as David passes her by again and rapes and impregnates and then marries Bathsheba. Will the world ever be a common humanity working together to solve problems and live in peace? How do we tolerate people who are intolerant? How do we respond to family and friends who continue to justify cruelty and discrimination against others? Why is there abortion? These questions come with stories. These questions come with hopes and fears, with wounds and healing opportunities, but they will only come with frustration, with more reasons to misunderstand and marginalize, with more license to hate and otherize, if we can't learn how to listen devoutly, and if we don't do our own inner work. What is at stake for us, my Jesus follower friends, is nothing short of the integrity of our faith. Listening devoutly means being vulnerable, being honest, being grateful for the gift of someone sharing their story with you, even if it's a hard-to-understand story, and being self-aware, which takes a lot of intentional work and a lot of courage. I can't tell you why there is abortion. Just like I can't tell you why 25% of all pregnancies end in miscarriage, or why 25% of women are the victims of rape or attempted rape, or why the world can be such a harsh place for people who are in pain. I don't know the answer to those questions. But I do wonder what's at stake in this question. Is it about finding the right answer to a moral dilemma? Is it about blaming or shaming? Is it about absolution and forgiveness? Is it about vulnerability and a sincere desire to stay connected when so many tell us that this issue must divide us, that we must choose a side? I cannot help engage this question with my own story, with my own memories of some of the most challenging moments of my now almost two decades of ordained ministry. I have walked alongside many women, all across the country, women who have suffered mightily from the fact that our country has politicized something that is so profoundly personal, our bodies. I have walked with women through shattering pregnancy loss. I have walked with women through infertility, miscarriage, sexual assault, stillbirth, releasing a baby for adoption, medical emergencies, and yes, difficult decisions of termination. As a pastor, it's not my place to scrutinize decisions people make. It is my job to be a loving, compassionate presence in the most painful experiences of human life. So I'm there when people say goodbye to someone they've loved for a lifetime. I'm there when people lose jobs or struggle with sexual identity or decide that a relationship is over. And I'm there when you're angry or upset or confused or just need to talk, because that's what we're all called to be as beloved community. God, in your mercy, humble us. As the world turns and Facebook churns, may GCPC be a place that yearns to show the world the truth of Jesus' good news. Conflict and community go hand in hand in the kingdom of God. Without conflict, community becomes a parody of itself, mimicking relationships that make and give life while actually trivializing who God created us to be together. With conflict and with the Spirit's help, community can become a vivid expression of the very nature of God. Love that goes the distance healing requires and doesn't count the cost. Thanks be to God.